issues and stories and news events in your region. And the exchange is a huge part of that effort. Our budget, when we go through the budget process and we decide, okay, what are we going to be able to do? What are we not going to be able to do? We put quite a bit of financial effort into the programs and the news that you get right here from New Hampshire Public Radio. Your pledge dollars help offset those costs. So basically, you're paying for the service that you value so much. 1-888-805-6477 or join us online, nhpr.org.
We like it when our work sounds effortless, when you just turn on the radio and hear a fine, clean, crisp product with the kind of integrity and balance that you expect. But the truth is, there's a lot that goes behind that. Somebody has to book those shows. Somebody has to contact the individuals, arrange their schedules, arrange transportation, arrange communication costs. It's a huge effort. And you support it when you make a call. We are certainly appreciative, and we'd love to be able to send you this book, Where the Mountain Stands Alone, Stories of Place in the Monadnock Region. Perhaps no other region defines New Hampshire better than the Monadnock area. Lots of people come to hike Pack Monadnock and Monadnock itself every year. $150 pledge is what we're suggesting for that. We'd love to be able to send this gorgeous book to you. You can see it online when you pledge there at nhpr.org, too. And thanks.
Additional support for New Hampshire Public Radio comes from Systems and Communication Sciences Incorporated of New Ipswich and from Granite Ledges of Concord, an assisted living community for long and short-term stays located on the Concord Hospital campus. Information online at graniteledges.com. This is New Hampshire Public Radio, celebrating 25 years of great radio in the Granite State.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. Think of the Monadnock region and pleasant images come to mind. A quintessential New Hampshire landscape that spells order. The tidy town green, the neat white church, Main Street at the center. But the natural landscape underlying this region was created in anything but an orderly way.
The terrain of the Monadnock region and of the White Mountains and their adjacent uplands is unique in North America. It's among the continent's most unpredictably variable topographies. To the west, the Green Mountains rise as a range of massive, regular ridges marching in orderly Appalachian ranks all the way to Georgia. But to the east, north, and south, New Hampshire's horizons are boisterous, disorderly, and everywhere surprising. New Hampshire is a relatively new addition to North America. The Green Mountains and the Appalachians west of the Connecticut River were already more than 160 years old and neatly folded in place when New Hampshire arrived. The forces of continental drift pushed three or four large landmasses together and sent them crashing toward the Green Mountains' shores. Each impact raised a new series of folded mountains, and each mountain raising was preceded and accompanied by massive volcanic upwelling. The geological tumult continued for more than 350 million years. Then, 100 million years ago, glacial ice, enough frozen water to lower the world's oceans by 350 feet, moved across New Hampshire. The landscapes that emerged from under that ice 10 to 12 millennia ago are the products of the interactions of rock, ice, and water.
And out of these interactions and this tumult eons ago came one lone mountain, the enduring, beloved Monadnock. Now a new book called Where the Mountain Stands Alone, Stories of Place in the Monadnock Region, explores the area's physical landscape and its profound impact on the people, culture, economy, and psychology of southwestern New Hampshire. And the book offers a broad historical perspective on what we see there today. For example, because the Monadnock area was regarded as an economic backwater for so long, much of what we value there now, the old barns, farmhouses, and grange halls, were preserved, mostly because no one was much interested in tearing them down to build something new. Today in The Exchange, the themes in Where the Mountain Stands Alone, and we want to hear from you. Join us with your questions and thoughts, your stories of what makes the Monadnock area unique. Our number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477. NHPR. Joining me in the studio this morning, Howard Mansfield. He's the author of multiple books, including the recent Bones of the Earth, and editor of the one we're talking about today. Again, it's called Where the Mountain Stands Alone, Stories of Place in the Monadnock Region. Howard Mansfield, it's really nice to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Good to be here.
Also with us, John Harris, director of the Monadnock Institute of Nature, Place, and Culture. And John worked extensively with Howard Mansfield on this book, writing essays and, importantly, helping raise the money for it. And John Harris, it's good to meet you. Thanks for coming
in. Good morning. Thank you.
Well, Howard, you begin this book not specifically with the Monadnock area, but with an essay on our, what you call our cultural quest for placelessness. Now, what does that mean, and how does that fit into the Monadnock region?
The history of the country could be seen in one way as an attempt to make every place like every other place. It's the rise of the railroad. It's the attempt to make one national market. Lord Bryce travels the United States in the, I think it was the 1880s, and he says, my God, one city looks like another. He's just totally bored by it. And the Monadnock region gets into economic failure because it doesn't become part of the national market. It's not placelessness enough, really. So it fails. And it fails. The mills fail. The farms fail. Some of these towns in the Monadnock region are just today getting back to the population that they had during the Civil War and after, immediately after. So what you have here really is a story of failure and then the opportunity that failure brings.
Well, and the fact that the Monadnock region didn't go along, couldn't go along, because it was kind of this isolated pocket, did contribute to the failure. You talked about the mills, the farms, you know, everything had its brief little economic moment and then dwindled away. But, Howard, a little bit more, please, on how that failure did create tremendous opportunity today in the Monadnock region.
Well, what you had was an area that was really depopulated. We had towns failing. We have one essay in the book by Alan Rumrow, who's the director of the Historical Society of Cheshire County, about his town Stoddard. It got down to 113 people. There were three people in church on Sunday morning. One was his father. One was a minister. I suppose the other was a minister's wife. I don't know. That failure, that led to this place for everyone to come back and discover. First, the artists around Dublin, you know, Abbot Thayer and company, then summer people, then Massachusetts tax refugees, back to the landers, everybody making their own discovery of this place. And that is why today, still, there are large tracts of land to be saved in the region.
And it was great to read that in the book, because I'd never thought before about how earlier failure turned into, again, that opportunity. Much of the region has been preserved because nobody was interested in it for so long. What evidence do we see around the region, John Harris, of, again, those various failed enterprises?
Well, that's part of going out to collect stories from the people who were the laborers all over. We see it in tanneries. We see it in mills. For example, in Marlborough, there were 11 mills around the Minnewawa River. And now their buildings exist, but they're all shells of the former operations. We see it in farming. There were 1,000 farms in 1800, and now there are a few farms left along the Connecticut River. But the land and the people and careers have changed dramatically.
And you see, you walk in the woods and oops, you stub your toe on a stone wall.
We do. We have a wonderful essay by Tom Wessels, who certainly is the foremost reader of landscape clues in New England. And he picked out his parables of place, his favorite spots, looking at sheep fever on Gap Mountain, looking at Monadnock and the story of the wolves on the top of the mountain. So it's all over in the woods in the area, yes.
Well, you mentioned the tanneries, and that's one industry that I had sort of forgotten was so important at one point here in New Hampshire. And one of the great things about the book is that you do have the voices of people who did work in those industries. I want to play a little essay from the book. Again, it's called Where the Mountain Stands Alone. This is an essay called The Working Life by Jeffrey Douglas. And in this essay, he spoke to a man who worked in the Lawrence Tannery, is that right? Is that
right,
John?
In Winchester.
Okay, mm-hmm. Let's hear that.
Inside the tannery, my job was pulling pits. That is one messy, messy job. The pit is filled with brine, and the sheepskins are thrown into this brine solution. Then when the chemist determines the hide is cured properly, you pull the pit so that the hide can go on to the next stage. pulling these things, it's a gut-wrenching job because, you know, a sheepskin is heavy, soaked with water, and pulling it over the side of the vat and flopping them over the side, it's exhausting. First time I went in there, I was a young man and I was gung-ho, and I think I pulled 19 pits. Then you went to shower, and when I got out of the shower, there was a man waiting there, and he asked me, he said, "What are you, crazy? You can't turn all those in. We never pull more than 8 or 9 pits a day. You're going to ruin it for all of us." I had to give up a lot of those pits. No, I'm serious. Then after that, I knew how much to turn in. These jobs supported generations of Winchester natives, as well as many from Keene, Richmond, Hinsdale, Swansea, and across the river in Brattleboro, Vermont. At the high point in the late war years, with half the bomber jackets of the Allied forces being prepped at the Winchester plant, the tannery was operating around the clock, 700 employees on 3 shifts, processing 84,000 skins a week, with buses arriving and departing 3 times daily from Keene.
A reading from Where the Mountain Stands Alone, Stories of Place in the Monadnock Region. That's the book we're looking at today in the exchange. And we'd like to hear from you. Join us with your stories, your thoughts about what makes this area unique. 1-800-892-6477 is the exchange number, 1-800-892-NHPR. With me in the studio, Howard Mansfield. He's the author of many books and editor of this one. And John Harris, director of the Monadnock Institute of Nature, Place, and Culture. One more time, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. That was a great reading about the tanneries, and the book reminds us of all these other enterprises that never really quite worked out. Howard Mansfield, there was the sheep craze, there was the mills, gosh, what else was there? I mean, it just seemed like every 20 or 30 years, people in the Monadnock area were trying something and then moving on to something else.
Well, I guess to the roster of failure, you could add the railroads. There was just one railroad in the entire of New England, and when that left a huge hole. One thing that was successful is, according to Roger Swain in this book, all cultivated blueberries have an ancestor in one blueberry bush on a hillside in Greenfield.
Really?
Roger Swain, as you know, is the old Victory Gardener, and if he says it's so, it must be. There was an agricultural extension agent, I think it was, he was up here summering, and he was determined to improve the blueberry, and he found a hardy stock in New Hampshire.
Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Howard mentioned the railroads. John Harris, how did the railroads change the Monadnock region, at least briefly, until they, again, flashed in and flashed out?
Well, the railroad came early to Keene, actually. 1840s, a railroad came through, and the towns that inherited the railroad were boom towns. The towns where the railroad passed by became almost ghost towns. Peterborough and Jaffrey and Ringe received the railroad in 1870. Some of the hill towns where the railroad did not pass by are the places like the one that Alan Rumrell describes in Stoddard. So it made tremendous difference. Those that were failures, those were success. That was the transportation of milk. There were milk trains to Boston. There were trains that connected Vermont and New Hampshire across the Connecticut River in the 1850s.
So if you were a farmer whose farm happened to be located near the railroad, great. But if you're 20 miles away, you're out of luck.
That's right. Given the roads mire up in the spring and couldn't travel well in the winter, if you were not close by when the railroad passed through, I suppose it's like some of our superhighways today.
Let's hear an essay about just how this railroad system transformed the landscape of the Monadnock region.
The railroad transformed the landscape of the Monadnock region as well as the imaginations of those who lived there. Trestles, tunnels, overpasses, and culverts were constructed to minimize steep grades and connect centers of commerce. Time and progress were measured by the sound of the locomotive. The arrival of the railroad created winners and losers as industries and municipalities competed for connections to the existing rail lines. Cities like Keene struggled to accommodate a maze of tracks and sidings for loading and unloading freight, while towns that were bypassed like Stoddard and Roxbury quickly began to wither. The railroad magnified disasters as well as successes. On July 17, 1897, J.A. French photographed the wreck of freight train number 216 at Pemberton Crossing in West Keene. According to the Keene Sentinel, No gala day or celebration ever drew more people to West Keene than the railroad wreck on Saturday. An estimated 5,000 people visited the site where engineer Mylon Curtis was killed, and where more than 500 pigs escaped from their overturned cars into the nearby woods.
Again, that's a reading from Where the Mountain Stands Alone, Stories of Place in the Monadnock Region. The book offers essays and thoughts about the history of the region, how the landscape of the region is so closely tied to its people, its culture, its economy, its psychology. Join us 1-800-892-6477. If you have a special story of the Monadnock region, one that's perhaps part of your family or one that you experienced yourself. Also, is there something about the Southwest Western corner of our state that makes it unique? Join us 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Our guests, John Harris and Howard Mansfield. And gentlemen, we shouldn't go too much farther with talking just about the mountain. The mountain itself that dominates everything, that gives the region its name and so forth. First of all, Howard, if you could, just the basics on how this thing was formed. I mean, there it is, as the title of your book says, standing alone. All by itself. It's not part of a chain or a range or anything.
Yeah, and if I'm recalling my geology correctly, because it was granite, it didn't wear down as fast as everything that was surrounding it. We have a terrific essay about the mountain itself by Henry David Thoreau in here. He camped out on the mountain four times. This essay from his journals is from his last time, just a few years before he died. And it's the most amazing thing. It's a great lesson in seeing, which is what this book's about, because all of us have been up there at one time or another. We've never seen as much as Thoreau goes on to describe. And it's also classic Henry David Thoreau. He scolds people for climbing up the mountain and looking off the mountain. They're not looking at the mountain correctly. I mean, he was such a pain. It's great. But what amazed me about this also is I asked around, have you read this? Have you read this? No one had read it. And so that's why it's in the book also. It's just a fantastic piece of writing.
It's very long, actually. He goes into great detail about, I saw this fern and that blueberry. And
absolutely
so
everything. And the pattern in the rocks and what it looks like when the sun sets on one side and what he hears from the top of the mountain. And he has good descriptions of the mill workers who are up there blueberrying and carving their names in the side of the mountain. He's got that great description of the clink, 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 those names you still see up there today.
And the list of what he took, and if he goes next time, what he would take less of,
don't
need as much
sugar. Which we've all said, yeah.
Yes.
We've all said that. I didn't need to bring that extra jacket. Now, one of you mentioned before the wolves, and John Harris, am I right? Does the sheep craze and the fear about wolves attacking your sheep have something to do with why Monadnock is so bald?
Well, that's something that Tom Wessels points out in his essay. When Thoreau was climbing Monadnock, he met someone who said that in the 1820s, the reason that the mountain was bald is that the fire was started to burn wolves off the mountain. And what Tom Wessels points out is the Great September Gale of 1811 was a hurricane that passed right over the mountain and knocked down primarily hemlock that would be on the top of the mountain. And those would have been drying and ready for the fire. So whether it was an actual fire that was set or lightning, it burned so hot because of the amount of timber there that it would have burned down below the level of soil. And that's really the reason that the mountain has come down to the stone.
And Howard, how does that mountain really define this region? Economically, culturally, psychologically?
It's unusual in that it is what unites the region. It is what people define their relationship to and from the mountain. And it's also kind of undefinable. I mean, I've been thinking about that, and I don't have a really concise answer for you on that.
People just, even people who never climb it, seem really attached to it. And everybody's got their own view of it. I've got the view from Jaffrey. Well, I've got the view from Keene.
Yeah, apparently, I guess when Jaffrey put that on its sign a few years ago, home of Mount Monadnock, and then people over in Dublin or Troy learned that they had the backside of the mountain. They weren't happy about it.
Well, and Judd Hale has his 10 favorite views of Monadnock
Right. Included
in the book as well. So people really respond to that.
Well, and Thoreau says in his essay, it's not so much about climbing, or it's just as much about climbing the mountain and looking out as it is being down and looking up at it. I mean, that's how you experience it on a daily basis. How would you answer that question, John, that I asked Howard? How does the mountain define this region?
Well, I wrote an essay about the borders and boundaries of the region. And often in regional studies, watersheds are used as the boundary. But watersheds, because they connect people from such a wide range, geographically, I think a geographical entity like a mountain is able to kind of gather people around, make some much more defining decisions. It was interesting in thinking about the Monadnock region. Certainly there are some geographical boundaries like the ridge of mountains along Monadnock and the Connecticut River, but there are also some political boundaries that, and to the north there's a kind of a gray area, a fuzziness that I think is important for a region as well. So people can pick and choose based on issues whether they want to belong to the Monadnock region. Certainly people can see the mountain from hundreds of miles away, but the region, as we try to describe it and bring the stories together, are the about 35 towns that surround the Monadnock.
Again, our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. We're learning more about the Monadnock region through a new book called Where the Mountain Stands Alone. We'll take your calls in just a moment, 1-800-892-6477. And John Harris and Howard Mansfield, I've got a lot more questions for you, too, when we come back from a short break. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Here's what listeners like you are saying about The Exchange.
Hi, great. Good morning. This is a great program, and I've been prompted to call in many times, but this is the first time I've gotten through. Good subject.
You have a great show. I just wanted to comment on that because I listen to it almost religiously. I think it's a great show.
Hi. I'm a first-time member on Monday, so I was like, now I can call and feel good about it.
It's your calls that make The Exchange great. And it's your support that makes it all possible. Call 1-888-805-6477 to make your pledge to NHPR. And thanks.
Well, it's great to hear from NHPR listeners this morning during the fall membership drive. Good morning. I'm Lisa Peeks, and I'm here with Laura Kanoy right now with a special reason for you to go to the phones and call 1-888-805-6477. And that is because with your $150 pledge this morning, you'll get a copy of the book that Laura's been talking about.
$150 pledge, put it on your credit card, call 1-888-805-6477 or call 1-888-805-6477 or go online at nhpr.org. Lisa, I have to say, I have this book right in front of me. It is gorgeous. It is absolutely gorgeous. It has paintings, photographs, watercolors. The essays are terrific. It explores so many of the cultural themes that are relevant, really not only to the Monadnock region, but to many other areas of New Hampshire, I would say as well. You'll recognize a lot of the authors in this book, too. Jane Brox, Ernie Hebert, Cy Montgomery, Howard Mansfield. They are all included in this book, and it would be a terrific gift for someone in your life as the holidays approach. 1-888-805-6477 is the number. It's yours for a pledge of just $150 to NHPR.
It's so special when something's autographed, too, and that is the case with this particular book. Call to support New Hampshire Public Radio. It's your calls over the years that have helped New Hampshire Public Radio grow. NHPR doesn't get a lot of money from anywhere else but from you. We're independent. We've always been that way. From when we started 25 years ago, when we had about 500 members, now we have about 14,000 members, and you provide the most reliable sources of income for NHPR's news and information services. We say most reliable, what we mean is that we've always been able to depend on you to go to the phone and do your part, whatever that part is. Call now, 1-888-805-6477.
Pick up a copy of the book when you do for a pledge of $150 to NHPR. 1-888-805-6477 is the number. Lisa, you said it beautifully. You know, listeners are our most reliable source of support. It's the one major funding source we can always count on, and that's New Hampshire Public Radio members. So Lisa and I are asking every listener right now to become a partner with this station. You are, after all, the people who use NHPR on a daily basis. Do your part. Make a contribution, 1-888-805-6477, or online, and you can look at the book, too, while you're there, I think, at nhpr.org. org.
That's just an extra benefit for calling and supporting New Hampshire Public Radio. One of the best benefits of supporting this station and becoming a member is that you're going to feel good. Becoming a new member or renewing your support just takes a few minutes. Take a moment to support news and information, and take a look at this book, too, Where the Mountains Stand Alone. It's a great history of the Monadnock region, and it's not just dry text. It's beautiful, rich essays accompanied by pictures, photographs, watercolors, paintings. Gorgeous book, really is, and it says New Hampshire like few other things. And The Exchange does the same thing. Features your voices, New Hampshire subjects, day in and day out, and your call supported. 1-888-805-6477 is the telephone number. Find out more about the book at nhpr.org when you make a pledge there.
You know, Lisa, as I travel around the state and meet listeners from newcomers to New Hampshire, what I often hear is, The Exchange is where I learned about New Hampshire, and thank you for educating me. Thank you for letting me know a little bit about what this state is all about. If that is you, if you appreciate the way that we have brought different aspects of New Hampshire to you, as Lisa said, day in and day out, well, you really should become a member of New Hampshire Public Radio, someone who contributes to the success of this enterprise, someone that really, well, does their part and steps up, takes a little responsibility for their listening and says, yep, I listen. And I understand how public radio works, and I understand it's only here because of contributing listeners like me, members of this radio station. I know that you want to help out. I know that you want to become a part of it. So please do call now, 1-888-805-6477. Just about half an hour left to get your hands on this beautiful book, Where the Mountain Stands Alone.
You know, it's so true that the way that you hear about things and learn about things, the way you're educated on programs like The Exchange and with everything else that you hear on New Hampshire Public Radio is really what distinguishes the service. You learn through the perspectives of other people, other listeners like you who call in with their support. Again, the number is 1-888-805-6477. 25 years ago, when NHPR signed on the air, there was no Exchange. The Exchange celebrated its 10th birthday not long ago, and that's just been fantastic. But at that time, the average annual income 25 years ago, about $19,000. Postage stamp cost 18 cents. It seems quaint to look back in retrospective. But NHPR had humble beginnings, too. 30,000 listeners, staffed mostly by volunteers. These days, our staff is about 35, 40 people. We are paid, not extravagantly, but what we're worth. And your calls of support help pay for everything. You decide what the station is worth to you and call and make that support. You're going to feel good that you finally got on board during the membership drive and called in your pledge. 1-888-805-6477 is the telephone number. If you're just getting into work and want to pledge online, just go over to nhpr.org and make a pledge that way, too.
Additional support for New Hampshire Public Radio comes from Northeast Delta Dental, providing dental benefits to businesses of all sizes and individuals throughout New Hampshire, Maine, and Vermont. Information online at nedelta.com. And Tracy Bank Saab & Concord is sales service satisfaction, a bank's family tradition since 1957. 1-800-NEW-SAAB online at tracybanksaab.com. Saab, born from jets. This is NHPR celebrating 25 years of great radio in the Granite State.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Canoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, New Hampshire's 2nd District Congressman Charles Bass joins us to talk about his bid for re-election. That's Thursday on The Exchange. Today we're looking at how the landscape of the Monadnock region has shaped the people, culture, economy, even psychology of southwestern New Hampshire through a new book called Where the Mountain Stands Alone, Stories of Place in the Monadnock Region. Our guests are Howard Mansfield, author of many books and editor of the one I just mentioned, and also John Harris, director of the Monadnock Institute of Nature, Place, and Culture. He worked extensively with Howard on this book. Our phone number here in The Exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Let's get your stories, your questions, your thoughts on what makes the Monadnock region so unique. 1-800-892-6477. John and Howard, let's go to Hancock first, and Sally's on the line. Go ahead, Sally. Welcome.
Hi. Love the show, and I love the book. I know what I'm giving people for Christmas this year. I wonder if Howard and John could address this question, and that is, if failure is what saved this place from placelessness, What threats do success pose today?
It's a great question, Sally. What do you think? John Harris, I'll turn to you first.
Well, I think the essay that Jerry Burns writes in the book about Ringe, and he attempts to answer that by looking in different driveways, people who are planning to leave Ringe because it's too populated, people who have just moved in. One of the threats certainly is the rise of new large homes in the outskirts of the region and commuting beyond the area toward Boston. To some extent, a town like Hancock and the Harris Center, the decisions to conserve land, to put as much land as possible in conservation, is one protective measure that the Monadnock region has been fortunate to kind of get ahead of the curve and do that sort of protection, although it's a real challenge. I mean, the area is a backwater in part, but the more books like this celebrate it, the more careful we have to be about making sure it doesn't get changed too rapidly.
People will see this book and go, gosh, it's beautiful. I want to move there, too.
Right.
Howard, what are your thoughts on Sally's question?
Success is a threat if it's an off-the-rack, big box, just pave it, sprawl kind of success, the same kind of success. That's just eating up the country all over the place. But if we can redefine that and try and somehow live with the scale of these 18th and 19th century main streets, these town commons, and that's the struggle that's going on in town after town and at zoning boards and at planning boards, and that's what people are really wrestling with, and it's no quick answer to that at all.
Well, how do you preserve, and this is, you know, the subject you could go on all week for this, Howard, how do you preserve what you have without becoming too quaint, too cute? You know, the downtown, all you can really buy there is cute little gifts. You can't buy tape or string.
Yeah, I you know, that is the question. It's not about stopping change. It's about shaping change. It's about trying to find the right fit. It's a hard thing to do because everybody's expectations today are completely different. Everybody wants more and more things. And the more and more things have, the more those things displace the qualities we really are striving for.
Sally, thanks a lot for the question. And let's go to Dublin next. Jarvis is on the exchange. Jarvis, go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning.
Morning.
I just been following a lumber truck. And I know 100 years ago that this area was pretty well deforested. Do you have any information on how the original timbering was done? Was there a logging industry in this area, and how extensive it was?
Jarvis, it's a great question because it's not one of the industries that we touched on earlier. John Harris?
Well, we have quite a few pictures of oxen hauling logs and sawmills. They were prevalent throughout the region. In fact, the stories that we focus on primarily deal with the Pisgah State Park area, which was a real frontier. And looking at stories, we found some tapes. And one of the wonderful things about a book like this is that every historical society has a box of audio tapes. And listening to those tapes, there were people, mainly French Canadian loggers, who were working before the hurricane of 38 in Pisgah. And they cut a lot of trees. They hauled those trees out. They had portable sawmills right in the area. And that was true, even steam-powered sawmills, wood-powered, water-powered mills before that throughout the Monadnock region.
So sawmills were important at one point.
Certainly very important. Grist mills and sawmills were some of the earliest businesses that were established when people first moved up in the 1750s.
Wow. So what pushed them out? What sort of made that, I mean, again, we talked about all these different economic enterprises that came and went.
Pushed out the mills. Well, originally the water was no longer necessary. There were steam-powered sawmills. There were electric-powered sawmills. There were many sawmills set up after the hurricane of 38 in the region just because there was a lot of down timber
there. Right.
And ultimately, it's changed. There's still a number of sawmills. There's one that right along Route 12 that I guess has made the decision that it's no longer going to be sawing logs.
You know, while we're talking about the mills, it's important to note that in addition to sawmills and grist mills and then the later woolen mills, is that water power was tremendously important in the region. And it's one of the reasons why the area looks the way it does today, because almost every body of water, every brook, every lake, every pond, was changed and dammed for water power. so that we pretty much have the benefit of that industry. When you're out there kayaking and thinking you're in a natural lake or pond, you probably aren't.
You know, I never really thought about that. But as you were talking, Howard, one of the great things about the Monadnock region is that there are, everywhere you look, you know, it's not where can I go swimming, it's which of the 30 different great little places can I go swimming.
And they're not natural. There's a, we have an essay in the book about Harrisville, New Hampshire. The colonies and the Harrises and what happened to the mills when they closed and how there's a battle, which is mostly resolved now, between the Harrises, who the colonies, excuse me, who still actually own the water of Lake Newbanusett, and the summer people who want it at a certain level, and the colonies who have a liability if the water's too high, and say, like in the hurricane of 38 when it flooded through Peterborough. So you've got a change from water power to leisure power. And it's a whole change in the way people regard the landscape.
And the colonies are the...
Colonies are the people who own the mills in Harrisville.
Yeah, it's not a colony of people. It's the family name of a group of people who are responsible for these water levels.
They actually own the dam.
And there's a lot of pressure on them to make sure that it...
The water's at a certain level, yeah.
Right. All right, our phone number again on the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Today in the exchange, we're looking at a new book called Where the Mountain Stands Alone, Stories of Place in the Monadnock Region. It's a collection of remembrances, essays, photos, beautiful paintings that look at the uniqueness of this region, how its landscape shaped its people, its culture, and its economy. 1-800-892-6477 is our number, 1-800-892-NHPR. Join us with your questions, thoughts about the Monadnock region, what makes it unique, whether you have a story about this region from your own experience or your family's experience. 1-800-892-6477. Gentlemen, we talked earlier about how the Monadnock region's relative isolation affected their economy, and we went into that in some detail. But what about the culture, Howard? How did this sort of being in this pocket all by yourself affect the culture of the Monadnock region?
One was that it was sort of there to be rediscovered. There's the artist Abbot Thayer, who was responsible for saving, in part for saving Mount Monadnock, the persistence of contra dance music, these kind of things really kind of gave the area a character.
Because it was, again, its own little place.
Yeah. Exactly.
I noticed that still today, you know, Concord and Manchester have their own culture, but they're also so close to Boston that people do, you know, people in Concord go to Manchester, people in Concord and Manchester go to Boston. In Keene, that's kind of it. You know, you're still that isolated place, so you do develop your own cultural outlets.
Yeah, I think that's true to a certain extent.
You mentioned contra dancing. There's an essay in the book about contra dance in the Monadnock region. Let's hear that.
Nowhere, then or now, is the scene stronger than in Cheshire County in southwest New Hampshire. Country dancing has a richer heritage here than anywhere in the entire country. It has shown a remarkable resilience going back to the days before the Revolution. Yeoman stock of Scottish, English, and Irish families brought the music and dance forms with them from the old countries. Dance masters from Boston helped spread waltzes and quadrilles around the highlands, and especially contras, line dances in which partners made simple moves, joining hands in a circle, crossing forward and back, swinging do-si-dos. But the long winters and rugged isolation of the region kept most outside influences at bay. The dancing generally took place in kitchens and barns and passed down through generations and families. After the Civil War, when minstrel shows and military bands made contras out of date and out of fashion elsewhere, the old dances hung on around Monadnock and in remote pockets of Vermont and western Massachusetts. The jigs and reels were kept alive, sometimes single-handedly, it seems, by passionate, itinerant musicians such as John Putnam of Greenfield, Massachusetts, and John Langdon Britton of Cheshire County. With the Industrial Revolution and jazz eras came new assaults on the old ways, but also a new group of immigrants from French Canada to work the mills in Keene and Swansea and Harrisville, immigrants who infused their own flavor of old-time fiddle tunes and dance steps.
Again, that's an essay from Where the Mountain Stands Alone, Stories of Place in the Monadnock Region. I love that, John Harris. The old dance steps hung on.
well, it's... It's certainly one of many things that were part of the traditions that have been preserved in the region. I think people make the choice to be there in some ways because of the landscape, because of the community that still exists. One thing we were hoping to do with this book was develop a sort of national model in how communities might communicate and converse with one another, and also strengthen that sense of the fabric that exists in community by sharing stories, not only the stories that are in the book, stories by professional writers, stories by people who are laborers like Chet Bamba, who pulled those pits in the tannery, but also once the book is published, get together on numerous occasions, conduct story circles, talk about the essays that are here, share new stories, and continue to enrich and develop and enhance and celebrate the region as it is.
And you're having a symposium to that effect this weekend.
Well, we are. We've been promoting the book in a number of ways, but we are going to gather about 15 of the essay authors in Ringe. Every year, the Monadnock Institute at Franklin Pierce College conducts a symposium on a place-related theme. And this year, we'll have panel discussions. So, for example, we want to investigate the Monadnock Yankee and have Ernie Hebert talk about, he sort of defined the Monadnock Yankee, a woman named Janice Ray, a Southern writer who has some issues with the New England Yankee, and another writer, Paul Hernicky, who's looking at the immigrant perspective on the Yankee stories.
How could anyone have issues with a Monadnock Yankee?
Well, I'll tell you a little story that Janice, she lives in Brattleboro, and she was walking into the post office, and she said to a fella in with her, sort of charismatic Southern accent, howdy. And he looked at her and continued to walk. And so she again stopped him and said, that was a big hello. And he looked at her like she'd just escaped from the retreat and kept on walking. And so she's feeling that some of that Yankee frugality isn't exactly what she came for.
Southerners are very aggressive about their hospitality.
New Englanders are not.
They're not. Yeah, they're retreating, yes. Absolutely.
Howard, you know, it's interesting. John talked about a broader goal with this book, not only to create a beautiful book that's informative and so forth, but to, well, extend the sense of community, bolster the sense of community in other areas of the country. Could you do that, though, in places that are so rapidly changing, rapidly growing? I don't want to pick on any one particular area, but, you know, Southern New Hampshire, for example, it's suburban, it's smalls, it's...
I think you could. I think it would be harder, but I think in each place there are different levels of time in the landscape. There's the up-to-date housing tract or mall, but there's the back roads, there's the landscape shaped by old storms and old farming and different memories in the land. I think you could do that, and I think that is possible. One thing we hope the book does do for people, sort of get them out to look at their home place, to be tourists of the near at hand, to just go look at things that they just drive past all the time, to appreciate things that they wouldn't even think about. In Keene, we have a wonderful essay by Paul Hernicky about the Italian community. Now, a lot of people, when Paul went over there, a lot of people, people say, I didn't know there was an Italian neighborhood in Keene. And it's just tucked in there, and it's just this wonderfully rich and continuing neighborhood.
So when you drive past that mill, you think about the worker who used to work there. When you drive past that pond that you enjoy so much, you think about the industry that helped create that pond.
Yeah, the history is not so much in the past, it's all mixed together in the present.
And when you stub your toe in that stone wall again, you there remember the sheep craze and all the other things. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Again, 1-800-892-6477. To Whitefield, and Ray is on the exchange. Hi, Ray. Thanks for calling in.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I listen to you folks and Diane Rehm all the time. In fact, I was just finishing up my daily stretching, because when you get old, you have to stretch a little bit. But what I have is a little story. I was a teacher in an inner city school in Connecticut back in the 1970s, and one of the field trips I would take, because I was fairly familiar with Mount Monadnock, was to climb Mount Monadnock. And as anyone knows, as you approach Mount Monadnock from the south, you can see it in the distance, and the kids would say to me, wow, we're going to climb that mountain? Because, you know, they had never seen anything
right.
more than a hill before. And it became one of the talking spots or the talking areas of for the rest of the year, because these kids, again, I mentioned they were from the inner city, never seen a mountain before, and it was great fun for them, and I always remember Mom and Adnock for that.
Well, you know, Ray, it's a great story, and we should mention, John, that even though it looks imposing, Mount Monadnock is either the most climbed or second most climbed mountain in the world, right?
That's what they say. I guess
either us or Mount Fuji.
Mount Fuji, right. Those are the two, without a road to the top. So over 125,000 people each year climb the mountain. And most of them go from the steeper side, the side that the glacier sort of plucked away things. You can walk from the Dublin side, and it's a gentler walk, but much longer.
And what do you think makes it so much climbed? Again, you know, it's not exactly right off of I-93 or, you know, easily accessible. I mean, it's not hard to get to, but it's not the quickest drive to Mount Monadnock.
Right. I think some of it, I mean, is the history that's a part of the tradition of climbing the mountain. It's certainly because there was a railroad stop in Troy. Many of the luminaries in Boston in the 1800s would come up, and there were hotels and guest houses that were established there. So it became a place that you'd spend the entire summer. There's an essay about Willa Cather and her delight with the mountain. Part of it is staying in Jaffrey, and part of it is the Shattuck Inn, which was close to the mountain. Today, people tend to go up, take a trip in the morning, hike the mountain, and head back down, head home. So there have been issues about how many people can park there, how the trail will actually, erosion on the trail, how we'll handle that.
Mountain being loved to death, that's what you often hear. I'm glad you mentioned tourism. Could you talk a little bit, Howard Mansfield, about how, again, the Monadnock region evolved from this economic backwater? I hate to keep using that, but we've talked about some of the economic failures. No. And that's not the case today, certainly. How did it evolve, though, from that to a place that you really want to spend, you know, your summer, and it's a great tourist destination? How did that evolution take place?
Well, it begins with the artists. It begins with the governor saying, come back.
Frank West Rollins.
Rollins, thank you.
Old Home Day.
Come back and buy the land. And slowly you get the tourists, you get the summer camps, you get the back to the landers, and bit by bit it's rediscovered. We have a wonderful essay in the book by Edie Clark, who a lot of people know from her essays in Yankee. She came to the area as a back to the lander. Her and her husband from the suburbs, from the cities, had no clue what they're doing. They bought a coal stove, pushed it up against the wall, and burned green wood their first winter. But they're still here. So it's a wonderful, she really captures that time of when the back to the landers were here thinking they could, you know, be self-sustaining on a piece of New Hampshire land. It just comes right through.
Well, gentlemen, I want to thank both of you very much for coming in, and I want to remind people that there is a symposium again on this book on Saturday at Franklin Pierce College. If you want more information, links to our website have it, nhpr.org. John Harris, thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. It's been delightful. Enjoyed talking about it.
Well, it's a great book. And John Harris is director of the Monadnock Institute of Nature, Place, and Culture. Howard Mansfield, thank you also for coming.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Howard Mansfield, author of many books and editor of the one that we're talking about today called The Mountain, Where the Mountain Stands Alone, Stories of Place in the Monadnock Region. Since we finished our discussion talking about tourism, I want to end the program today with an essay again from the book. It's by John Coffin from 1940, inviting you to visit and live in what he calls the Land of New Hampshire Charm.
If you're tired of the city with its noise, its rush, and its dirt, the folks of the Monadnock region invite you to be their neighbor, to share with them this land rich in traditional culture and Yankee genuineness, a land that nature has generously endowed with her entire treasure of beauties. You would be happy, contented in a region like this. Amidst its high, health-giving altitude, ambition is nourished. You feel more like working and can do more. Enjoy a home among the hills in the Monadnock region with its long list of advantages. Here you find scenic splendor at every hand, backed up by modern needs. Wide-surfaced concrete roads speed you quickly back from Boston, while local firemen and state and local police have guarded your interests while you were away. Pure water, seasonal vegetables from nearby gardens, modernly managed stores at your service, good schools, economical living costs, and the convenience of electricity in all but three towns are other advantages of the region. Many sites bordering Mountain Lake or Main Street are available, with a choice of rebuilding a typical home or consummating those plans you've drawn. And bear in mind that low tax rate on Monadnock Region property is not the least of its benefits. Whatever your pursuit, industry, commerce, agriculture, or rest, live in our region and be happy.
You can be happy by making a pledge of support to New Hampshire Public Radio at 1-888-805-6477. That little piece was part of an essay from the book that we've been talking about on The Exchange this morning. And you can have that book with a $150 pledge of support to NHPR. Again, the number is 1-888-805-6477. Support The Exchange, generously endowed with an entire treasure of beauty, as the essay says. Good morning, I'm Lisa Peeks. I'm here with Laura Kanoy, asking for your help today.
All you have to do is call 1-888-805-6477 or pledge online at nhpr.org. At the $150 level, we have seven copies of this book left, seven hardbound autographed copies of Where the Mountain Stands Alone, Stories of Place in the Monadnock Region, edited by the well-known and respected New Hampshire author Howard Mansfield. It's a beautiful, beautiful book, and you can get your hands on it by calling 1-888-805-6477.
A discussion of culture has been going on all day this morning on The Exchange. Tomorrow, they'll be shifting gears, where there will probably be an exchange of differing opinions when Charles Bass and his Democratic challenger for Congress will be Laura's guests. Laura's been featuring election lead-up interviews with candidates, just as you would expect from New Hampshire Public Radio. Now, you might not agree with everything that you hear, but chances are that you agree there should be a place for a civil discussion of differing opinions. That's great. It means you're engaged, you're connected, you're listening to the voices of those with differing opinions. Good reason for you to consider making a contribution right now. Because you're being inspired and affected by what you hear, you can influence what others hear with your pledge of support. Again, the number right now is 1-888-805-6477. You can pledge online, too, this morning at nhpr.org.
During these fall membership drives, NHPR raises funds for, well, what it takes to create this type of programming. And how we do it is by asking you, our individual listeners, to donate, to pledge your support, to pay your small part of the costs of running this station. What do your contributions pay for? Well, the programs like The Exchange, the producers who help me put these programs on the air, the telephone lines for you to call in with your questions and comments. And your calls are such an important part of this program.